Welcome to After Hours, Conversations for Music Educators, presented by AMRO Music. This is where we share ideas and work towards solutions to better serve your students. This week, Nick Averwater talks with author and educator Scott Lang. We last spoke with Scott in December of 2020 about the State of Music Education Survey, which started as a result of the pandemic. The survey is now in its fourth version, with version 5 expected later in 2023, so we thought it was time to check back to see what has changed in the music education world post-pandemic. Our conversation is broken up into two episodes, and this is part one.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to After Hours, Conversations for Music Educators. I'm excited to welcome back my good friend, author, speaker, passionate advocate, Mr. Scott Lang. Scott, good to see you today.
Good to see you too, in all transparency, because I feel, unlike you, Nick, a personal responsibility to speak with candor and truth. It's 10 o'clock in the morning. This is not After Hours. So just to be clear, everyone, this is a sham. It's fake podcasting, and I'm calling you out for what you are.
That's a first on the show. But I'm really excited to sit down with you, always a pleasure, and talk about your State of Music Education survey. Now, for our listeners that may not be familiar with the survey, give us a little overview. What started this conversation? Really, what problem were you trying to solve with this survey that you put out?
You know, I was thinking about this earlier. You were involved really early on, Nick, and I don't know if it was version one or version two, but this is version four of the State of the Music Education Survey, and it all emanated from the pandemic. And I was getting lots of calls early pandemic. What are you seeing out there? What are you hearing? What do you know? And I'm really good at coming up with answers and just making stuff up. I mean, I've made an entire career out of it. But after like the fifth call, when I hung up, I thought, how do I not know what's happening out there? How does anybody not know? And so I put together a fairly brief survey, probably 8 to 10 questions, and it just centered on, are you remote? Are you distant? Are you hybrid? Are you, you know, what are you doing? What are your mitigation strategies? And so that was version one. Then we kind of thought, okay, there's something here. We need to have a national platform to have some baseline data about music education, at least be part of the music. We felt that way. So version two centered around, okay, we're starting to return to school in year two. And what does that look like? And what we did is we tried to ask a couple of new questions of things we didn't know, but we also wanted year over year data from year one. So what did enrollment look like? What did learning loss look like? What did all of those things, teacher morale look like? So fast forward 4 years, year four, this is by far and away the most in-depth survey that we've ever done. I literally have 62 slide decks of pivot tables and data points. And what we did is we kept three things that have been around since the very beginning. And it had to do with teacher morale, it had to do with learning loss, and it had to do with enrollment loss. But in year four, we added three new areas, and it had to do with budgeting, oversight, and instructional minutes. So a part of the State of Music Education Survey is a historic year-over-year look that we can look at long-term data. But then other parts are fluid and new each year as we desire to learn more about new parts of the profession.
So you mentioned that there's a couple of segments that you addressed in the survey. So we've got instructional time, student learning, enrollment, budget, admin support, and in state of mind. And what I would like to do is spend a few minutes on each category and really talk about what did the data tell us? And then what I would like to do is go deeper and say, okay, well now what? Not only what does this mean, but how do we act on this data as it relates to an individual educator? So let's just dive into instructional time. I mean, what did you unpack and uncover as it relates to instructional time?
I got to tell you, this part absolutely blew me away. I am stunned and amazed that after 32 years in this profession, I didn't know this data. This should have been day one of instructional pedagogy, year one of college. It started from watching my own sons teach. Now, there's two models to start beginners in this world, and in America is really a better reference. One is what's called the superimposed pullout program, which is where you meet every other day, every third day, every fourth day. It's not structured into the day. This is very common when you start kids in elementary school, fourth grade, fifth grade. Then there's the, for lack of a better example, a Texas model, which they start in the sixth grade and they meet 5 days a week. So what I tried to discern from this was, what's the instructional impact of that decision? What's the instructional impact of those two models? And about 60% of our country is on the Texas middle school model, because our country as a whole has moved to a middle school versus junior high school model. Middle school being 6, 7, 8, junior high school being 7, 8. About 40% of our country is still operating on the junior high or start beginners in 4th, 5th, 6th grade model. And when I compared the two, it was educational theft. It was, I couldn't believe it. That when you look at the data, it's stunning. And it basically says, if you start in elementary school under a superimposed program, you get 50% of the instructional minutes that you would have gotten had you started in middle school. In other words, if you start and you meet every third day, and we have all the data of how many days you met and how many minutes, if you start every third day, you got 97 fewer instructional minutes a week, 3,500 fewer instructional minutes a year, which equated to 2.5 lost days of teaching or 80 days a year. We were throwing away 50% of our instructional minutes. I don't know if we do that with math. I don't remember doing math every third day. I don't remember doing science every third day. I don't remember discarding and disposing of 50% of English. But that's what we do with music. And I could not believe, when I looked at the data, what the impact was in terms of instructional opportunities. And in full disclosure, the next question to ask that we didn't ask was a question that would be able to tie instructional minutes to dropout rates. And that's going to come in State of Music Education 5. But I believe with every fiber of my being, because I see it anecdotally, that not only are you getting less instruction, but the dropout rate triples if you don't meet every day. Because looking at my own children, anecdotally speaking, all his friends, all my kids' friends, both older and younger son, all quit music. And they all said the same thing. Oh, I tried it for 2 years. I wasn't any good at it. Well, you weren't any good at it because you only went every third day for 24 minutes. You got 1/3 of an education. You wouldn't be fluent in Italian if you got 1/3 of instructional minutes. You wouldn't be fluent in algebra if you got 1/3 instruction. You wouldn't be fluent in English if you only spoke it every third day. And so I think somewhere in the back of our minds, I knew this, but I didn't know this, that there's a right and a wrong way to teach music. And not the people, not the pedagogy, not the methodology, the structure of it. There is very clearly a right and a wrong way, and 40% of America is teaching music wrong, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, I was heading the direction of the retention rates. And so I'm so excited that y'all are going to address this next year, because that's going to be, I think, really eye-opening. And I tend to agree with what your gut instinct says. I mean, we have some data as it relates to like rental return rates. I mean, we can look at some data within our end and see, well, there's more kids dropping out of particular programs and not others. And so we have always had that anecdotal data, but never the statistical data that you all have too. So I'm really excited to unpack that with you, and I would tend to agree. So it'll be really interesting. Now what does that mean if you're an educator in one of those, the 40%, right, where you're doing either some sort of pull out or every third day or every fifth day, whatever it is? What do they do now? How do we act on this?
Well, I think there's a couple things, and it's a great question. And let's be real. I mean, I'm all about being real. Probably there's not a lot. I mean, I don't think for 1 second my school district's going to change the entire way they structure elementary school because I tell them they need to meet for music every day. I don't realistically think that's going to happen. But I do think there are some things we can do. Number one, we need to make decision makers aware of the data and its impact. And I don't think for 1 second that a principal, an associate superintendent, a superintendent of curriculum instruction, or a superintendent is intentionally making decisions that are incorrect for kids, that are not in the best interest of kids. I don't think that for 1 second. I'm a music educator for 32 years. I didn't know this data. So I think step one is making sure that the folks who are making decisions and informing those decisions are aware of the data. I think the second thing is comparison. The two things that I always felt like moved the needle with my administration were, number one, information and data. Number two, comparison. I need an assistant and an instrument repair budget for a new drum line, and here's what it costs, and here's the number of kids it'll impact, and here's what. And my principal would look at it and say, okay, I'll take that into consideration. I'd say, oh yeah, and our rival school, they just got an assistant band director, and he'd be like, what? Oh, whoa. Okay, well then let's talk about this. Information and comparison are the two things that I have always found move the needle. So if I took my son's high school, which has, and now keep in mind, to give you an idea, my son, my children's district requires music for every child, fifth and sixth grade. 100% take music, band, choir, or orchestra. Every kid. It's a common prep hour for the fifth grade, sixth grade team. My son's high school is 4,000 kids. Now, obviously impacted by the pandemic, there's 40 kids in the band program. That's 1%. If I go to my principal and say, here's the data, why this matters, and here's the impact it's having, and they go, oh, that's interesting. And I say, you know, a school of 4,000 in Texas has a band of 600. We're a band of 40. That's a problem. So I think number one is making people aware of the information and giving them comparison data. I think the second thing is understanding as an industry and as a profession and as a collegium that we have to speak with one voice. I don't think anybody's arguing the right way to teach algebra. I think they all accept it. I don't think anybody's arguing, unless you do whole language versus phonics, how we teach English. I don't think anybody's disagreeing, with how we teach history. But the thing is, we don't do that in music. We don't say this is a right way and a wrong way. Now, you can choose to teach something the wrong way. I can't change that. I can't make a principal make a different decision. But what I can do is present very clear case on what is the right way, what is the wrong way, and what is the impact of that choice.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this is great information, and I feel like we're just at the starting line of kind of unpacking how you start beginners and the total instructional time, particularly at these young ages, impacts long-term enrollment and participation rates in music. So I'm already looking forward to next year's survey as you're able to
get in and
dive in a little bit. But I think y'all are onto something.
I'm kicking myself. As soon as I started unpacking the data, I'm like, why didn't I ask the question? Why didn't I phrase a question that would tie when you started playing, how many days a week you went, and your drop rate? I mean, it was within an hour of closing the survey down and unpacking the data. So I am ready for State of Music Education Survey number 5.
Wonderful. Well, let's talk a little bit now about student learning. I know this was a big part, really the impact of the pandemic on, you know, where students are right now academically and musically. And what did we learn in the survey?
So there's two takeaways from the student learning. One is the donut hole of enrollment and the donut hole of learning loss are what they are. They're not getting better. They're not getting worse. They're not getting better. It's just working its way through the system. So this thought that, well, with time, we'll remediate the learning loss, it's not happening. It's just simply not happening. That donut hole, again, of enrollment and learning loss, they're tied together, are somewhere, depending on when you start, in the freshman, sophomore year of high school. They're right about there. Some people, it's a junior year already. Some people, they're still in eighth grade, depending on whether you start fourth grade, fifth grade, sixth grade. The point is, it's not getting better. It just is what it is, and it's moving its way through the system. The second takeaway was really a revelation to me, and I'm almost a little embarrassed I didn't see this coming. So, Nick, I'll answer your question with a question. The pandemic was an earthquake. I mean, it leveled us, it was unexpected, and it was significant and seismic. Fair point?
Fair point.
What comes after every earthquake?
You got to get out of the building, the aftershocks, right?
Aftershocks.
Continues to rumble.
We're seeing the rumblings now. And my point is that sixth grade class that started this year, that wasn't impacted by the pandemic, they're back on their normal schedule. There's no mitigation strategies. Learning loss is still down, not by as much, and enrollment is still down. There's aftershocks that followed the earthquake, and I didn't see that coming, and I probably should have. You know, that we thought the pandemic's over, yay, this beginner class will be back to normal. They're not. Call it readiness to learn, call it emotional preparedness, call it kids were happy being at home. Whatever the rationale, the reason is, that there's aftershocks. And so I don't know, you would have better numbers than I would probably at this point because of rental data. But what we're seeing enrollment-wise and learning loss, again, learning loss and enrollment are tied together. is that I call it the haves. So depending on where you were, Texas was one extreme, California was another. You know, it was 30% enrollment loss and learning loss, 22% learning loss, 25% if you were in California, but we'll just use a number, 30% post-pandemic. That number was halved the next year to about 15%. That number this year is about 7% down from where we were pre-pandemic. And I don't know if these numbers jive with your numbers. I'm seeing that pattern of halving. So I think next year, we're still going to be down pre-pandemic numbers by about 3%. Now, again, if you're in Texas, you might be up 5%. If you're in California, the two extremes of mitigation, you may be down 10%. But the national average is, I'm predicting, this is anecdotal, seeing the patterns of half, we have one more year of aftershocks, and that'll be next year. And I think enrollment will be down about 3%, and learning loss will be down, it will be halved again, and that a full return isn't going to happen until the fall of 2024. But then that sixth grade class now has to work its way through this system for 6 years. So I don't want to be doom and gloom, but I want to be honest and real that we're a full recovery for a sixth grade teacher, beginners, is likely this year or next. A full recovery for your last senior to leave high school is likely 6 years away.
Yeah. And when you say it, it makes perfect sense because, and you touched on the geography component, and I think that's very much at play from our side, because when we talk to retailers in the industry and they're talking about schools that still have active mitigation strategies in place, playing with masks and playing outside, and I'm not here to debate the validity of those things at this point, but rather just simply the impact that it does have on participation and role and enrollment. So I do think, and you mentioned the geography standpoint, but it makes perfect sense too, because how much of our recruiting is done with the siblings of current enrollees. And so that donut hole, there is also a recruiting component. You lost students whose siblings may have gotten exposure to the band or may have joined the band. And so you've got kind of this recruiting component pulling itself through that you kind of have to regroup, reset on all of this.
Well, and that's a really good point I hadn't thought about, to be honest with you. That's a really good point. But it's ancillary effects of the aftershock. So what was surprising when we did the survey is that the average tenure of service for a band director was significantly longer than it was for a normal teacher. 14.3 years for a normal teacher, 21.5 years for a music teacher that reported back to us. And the level of education was higher for a music teacher than it was for the average teacher. But here's why that's important to know. So, and this is taking like peanut butter and jelly and making a casserole out of it. But if the average tenure of service was 21.5 years, you're looking at a retirement wave in 8.5 years, which puts us right at 2030, which is when the donut hole will be graduating college. So all these kids, the absence of kids in music programs is the absence of kids becoming music majors, which is the absence of kids becoming future music teachers. And in my own little kind of stat geeked out data world, the greatest need for music teachers will coincide exactly with the greatest void of future music teachers, 2030.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just something to keep your eye on.
Well, and generally, it'll be interesting to, I follow you on that, excuse me, because I think there's a lot of validity in what the data is saying. We have this donut hole. What's the impact of the donut hole? I mean, you can carry that up and think about the impact on middle schools, high schools, universities, retailers, manufacturers. There's a whole donut hole there that follows itself through. How does that impact music education? But I also know that there's a lot of talk at colleges about a shrinking age population group that's kind of working its way through the schools right now, the impact that'll have on, and then just general college enrollment right now as well. So a lot of demographic trends kind of merging here at the same time. Oh, by the way, a pandemic and its impact.
Yeah, it's all super interesting. You know, it was a local newscaster on Twitter, and he wrote, it was during the whole discussion around debt forgiveness for college students. And he posted, how about teachers served in underschool areas in honor of forgiveness of debt? And I tweeted back, Well, first off, isn't doing an 80-hour week job for $37,000 forgiveness enough? And second, don't underserved kids need our most experienced teachers, not our newest teachers? Like, teaching is a complex thing, and it asks a lot of you, and financially, it doesn't return a lot. And it makes college not as attainable for folks given their exit profession. A stockbroker is going to make that money back pretty quick. But the runway for a teacher to make that money back, you know, I did that, we're off topic now, but I once did you'll get a raise if you get a master's degree. And I looked at the cost of my master's degree, and I looked at the raise I was going to get. I'm like, that's a 17-year proposition. Who invests that way? That's not a good use of my money. $25,000 to get a master's degree, $800 pay bump.
So Scott, really part two of what you uncover rolls very nicely into part three, and that relates to the enrollment overview. And so why don't you tell us a little bit about what some of the things that stood out to you there?
You know, the theme I would use for enrollment and learning loss is getting better, not back yet. That's the overall theme. That is enrollment better year over year from last year? Absolutely. Is enrollment loss better year over year? Absolutely. Are we back to pre-pandemic standards? Absolutely not. That's the bottom line. Getting better, not back yet.
Yeah. So let's lump these two together. And I intentionally did this. So such a similarity here between learning loss and enrollment numbers followed a very similar trend line. Okay. So what does this now mean for an educator? How do they act on this information? What does it mean for the objectives they set for their program themselves? What does this mean?
It's a great question. There's a couple things that my takeaway from this was. The first is, you know, if they look at the slide deck, and you got to really nerd out to look at the slide deck, which means Nick spent days on this, to be clear, because
you know
nobody's a bigger data nerd than Nick. The thing that the takeaways from this section are twofold. Number one is we've got to look at the entirety of the pillar, and that 50% of kids who start quit before high school, and roughly 70% of kids who start on an instrument don't finish on an instrument. And that's a systemic failure on our part. It just is. And, you know, we think about my program's attrition. We think about my enrollment. And me, I'm guilty of it. But I don't know if you know of any other industry that accepts a 70% failure rate with a smile. I don't. And that's what we have. 70% of kids who pick up an instrument or sing in fifth, sixth, seventh grade will not be doing that same activity 5 years later. And there's certainly an acceptable level of fallout. There's certainly a predictable level of fallout. There's certainly a necessary level of fallout. But 70%? So number one, we've got to start looking at it on a more systemic level, but on a more pillar level. In other words, if I'm the high school band director, I'm the high school choir director, how many of my kids that are in fifth grade right now are going to end up in my program? And what can I do to impact that? That we don't recruit and retain based on my program. We do it based on the life cycle of a child. That's my first actionable takeaway.
Okay. Tell me more about that. Yeah. Tell me about that. The life cycle of a child.
You know, the thing is, I think we compartmentalize education. Elementary school, middle school, high school. I do. You know, and curricula, English, math, science, physical education, music, extracurriculars, athletics. But when we're talking about the entirety life cycle of a child, that we don't look at it very holistically. We don't look at it, okay, we've got this kid and he's now six and he just walked into our building. What's he going to look like at 18? What do we want him to look like at 18? How do we get him to 18? Successful, healthy, and happy. How do we do that? And musically speaking, you know, I was very concerned with my middle school band program and especially my eighth grade class because that was my direct impact. I never once went to a general music classroom, never once. I may have wandered into an elementary band rehearsal once on accident, but I didn't think systemically or holistically when it came to kids. I compartmentalized them to my 4 years in my program, my sphere of impact. And I think that it does a disservice, not only to the child, but to our programs. And I think that is in part why we lose so many kids. Because if you go to, and this is one of the reasons Texas programs are so successful, it's the structure. That elementary music teacher that starts them, or middle school music teacher, they're also assisting at the high school. So they are thinking life cycle. You know, that high school teacher that is the assistant band director, he's also the brass coach at the middle school. And he's also doing beginner lessons at the elementary school. That they utilize the same system and the same personnel throughout the entire musical life cycle of that child. And I think that's one of the many reasons why programs using that model of middle school, 5 days a week, vertically aligned and intertwined, are seeing such a different, not only a different return in terms of the quality of their ensembles and their performances, but why their enrollments exceed national averages. You walk into a high school in that system, and I don't like to use a state, but a Texas, a school of 2,500 will have 270, 280, 300 in the marching band. In my state, you walk into a school of 2,500, there'll be 45, 65 in the marching band. And it's because we've compartmentalized their education and because we taught them incorrectly.
Yeah, and this is such a challenging topic to dive into because there are so many threads to pull. But what's amazing to me is that when I interact with those educators that have that what you're talking about, they have a statistically a much higher retention rate through. It is amazing to me how intentional the retention rate is. You know, I had on the podcast earlier this year Benjamin Easley at Nolensville High School, and he had a 100% retention rate in his high school band. Every single person that could return did return to his high school program. And I'll tell you, it was not an accident. Like it, there he was so thoughtful about how he structured and recruited and re-recruited kids into his program. It wasn't something left to chance. And I don't and I want to be careful here not to say that those that don't care about this, but it's got to be such a priority if you want to be not one of the 70%.
Well, the question you have to ask yourself: if I spent 182 instructional days is the average number of days in a year. If I spent 181 of them recruiting and taught an amazing lesson to 300 kids, is that a better outcome than if I spent one day recruiting and taught an amazing lesson to 3 kids?
Yeah.
You can't change the life of someone who's not in a chair. It's just that simple. We know the power of music. So now our number one responsibility is to make sure that every child has access to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this is certainly a topic that I know you're passionate about, just retention of students, the participation of students, getting more kids involved. And that's why you created Be Part of the Music, right? That's why you created
Absolutely. You were there from, the very beginning. I remember having barbecue with one night talking about it. You've always been there, Nick.
Well, it's a great thing you're doing, but you've got so much good data, and so I think for me too, one of the calls to action is now that you're tracking this, you know, it kind of gives us trend lines, of course, but it also kind of gives us some bars to set. Like we can go and look at the data and say, how am I doing nationally compared to other educators in this field, and take away some best practices.
Yeah, and we're certainly, if you go to bepartofthemusic.org, we've just launched our brand new dashboard. It's absolutely phenomenal. And one of the feature sets that you'll see on there is we have survey questions, and you can answer things and see how you trend nationally. And in future iterations, what you're going to see is we're going to be able to put enrollment trackers into the dashboard, and you're going to be able to see and compare numbers not just nationally, but on a state level as well. So it's evolving, but what we want to be able to do and will do is in the very near future is you're going to have the ability to look at your dashboard and see your enrollment for the next 6 years.
That's author and educator Scott Lang talking with Nick Aberwater about the fourth version of the State of Music Education Survey. You can learn more about Scott at scottlang.net. And this conversation will continue on the next episode of After Hours, Conversations for Music Educators, which is presented by Amro Music. This podcast is produced by Nick Aberwater and Joel Hurd in Memphis, Tennessee. And you can hear many more conversations at amromusic.com/afterhours.
Hey, if you enjoyed today's episode, here are two easy and fast ways you can support the After Hours show. First, your five-star review means a lot as it helps to boost us in the podcast rankings so that other music educators just like you can find us. Second, if you thought of someone that would enjoy this week's content and episode, hey, please share it with them so that they too can be a part of the After Hours community. Thanks so much, and we'll see you next week.